Okay, we're calling to order the first general session of the fall 2008 convention of the California Council of the Blind. Hey, you gotta be louder now. You know, we're competing, of course, this weekend. Two conventions are on ACB Radio. One is the Washington Council of Blind. Now, those guys in Washington, they scream out and they think they are the loudest. We have to prove to the world that we are louder. So let's hear it for the first session of the fall 2008 convention of the California Council of Blind. That's better. I like that. Okay. We're going to begin today with the Pledge of Allegiance from John Ross, who is president of the Greater Bakersfield Chapter. John, you want to come up here?
Mm-hmm. Please rise. Pledge. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we're now going to have here our invocation, which today comes from Minister Maurice, or Morris, I'm not sure which, Arterberry of the Apostolic Faith Church in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Mr. Arterberry?
Yes, sir. All right. Praise the Lord, everyone. All right. Yeah, all right. You can stand or you can sit. Praise the Lord. Those that can stand. All right. All right. Father, again, in Jesus' name, we thank you now, Lord, that we come to this session, Lord, in Jesus' name. We ask you to look on this meeting, Lord. Look on that agenda, Lord God, that they have to do in regards to you, Lord, in regard to their business, in Jesus' name. You said in all our ways to acknowledge you, and you would direct our paths, Lord. Now, we thank you and we praise you for what they're about to do, Lord. Give them guidance, hallelujah. Give them instruction, oh God, in the way you would have them to go. You said men ought to always pray and not to faint, Lord. We thank you now. We ask you to bless them as they go further, Lord, in this session. We pray and we give you thanks now. In Jesus' name we do pray. Amen and amen.
Amen. Thank you, Mr. Arterberry, for coming.
You're welcome, sir.
We greatly appreciate it. Do we have any announcements before we get started? Anyone has? Okay. Yeah, we do.
This is Gene Lozano. I'd like to make an announcement that tomorrow from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. that there's going to be an opportunity for people to evaluate some prototype emergency evacuation plan signs in the Santa Cruz room. You don't need to have an appointment. If you got low vision, you can go in there and you'll spend about 15 to 20 minutes of your time to evaluate these signs. Also, there will be some tactile signs, new ones, new designs, and both groups, people who go participate, will be involved in a drawing. Those with low vision would be a drawing for an iPod shuffle. I don't know why I can't remember shuffle. Anyway, and the thing is, the tactile sign ones, those who try that, if they win, they will get a set of the signs they could donate to a public building so we can get some accessible signage in some buildings. But it's really important. This is information that several of us are working on to provide the state fire marshal and to change the signs. And these are the signs you'll find over the car buttons, call buttons in the hallway at the lobbies of elevators that shows where you are and where's the nearest exit. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Gene. Okay. We have a wonderful program at this convention, and I just want to probably say it again before the end, but we are so lucky to have the convention committee and especially its chair, Gene Lozano, who works tirelessly, not only getting the speakers that we have, but also in taking care of all the logistics that's necessary to get them here and make sure that it all comes to fruition. I mean, I think our program, notwithstanding our ACB president out there, I think that no convention rivals ours for the speakers that we get, and I think we ought to be proud of it. Today we're going to lead off hearing a presentation on the Air Carrier Access Act and the Federal Aviation Administration initiatives to create employment opportunities for people with disabilities. Mr. Johnson, is the Equal Employment Opportunity Consulting Group in the Federal Aviation Administration's Office of Civil Rights. In this capacity, Mr. Bennison and his staff are responsible for assisting and advising the FAA Assistant Administrator for Civil Rights on affirmative employment and civil rights matters. In addition, Mr. Bennison oversees FAA's National People with Disabilities, Federal Women's and Hispanic Employment Special Emphasis Programs. Mr. Bennison's team also manages the implementation of equal employment opportunity management provisions. Mr. Bennison has a long and distinguished background in this area, and without further ado, I want to introduce to you John Bennison.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, everybody. How are you doing? How's the energy in the room? I will keep you awake. I know it's after lunchtime, so I will do my best to be entertaining and interesting. And I want to start out by saying to you that the issues that I'm going to be discussing today are not only important to me professionally as a management official with the Federal Aviation Administration, they're also very important to me personally because I am legally blind. And I know the challenges of being a person with a disability in the workforce, and my job, I have to tell you, requires me to travel about 1 week out of every month. So I know the very real challenges that people with disabilities face traveling in air travel in this nation. So I hope that I can adequately address some of the questions you may have and provide you with some information that will be useful to you. But again, I want to emphasize that the issues that I am going to discuss are very important to me professionally, but also personally as well. So, and I'm just so grateful for the opportunity to be here with you today and share some very important information. As you heard, I'm going to start my presentation by talking with you about employment opportunities for people with targeted disabilities at the Federal Aviation Administration. The Federal Aviation Administration seeks to become a model employer for people with targeted disabilities. Now, I don't know how many of you have heard the term targeted disabilities before, so I want to spend a moment explaining what I mean when I say targeted disabilities. This is a term that the federal government uses, and individuals with targeted disabilities are a group of people with disabilities that the federal government, as a matter of policy, is placing special emphasis on recruitment, employment, hiring, advancement, and retention of this group. People with disabilities that the federal government is placing special emphasis on recruitment, employment, hiring, and retention of this group. These are individuals with the most severe kinds of disabilities and the ones that have the highest unemployment rate. Now, blindness is a targeted disability. Being blind in both eyes is considered a targeted disability. Being legally blind is considered a targeted disability. So you should know off the top that if you are looking for employment, the Federal Aviation Administration is, and you're a highly qualified, highly skilled, highly motivated individual, the Federal Aviation Administration is looking to employ you. So it's very important for you to know that we are seeking to become a model employer for people with targeted disabilities, and blindness is considered a targeted disability by the federal government. Now, again, to become one of the major efforts that we've engaged in to become a model employer for people with targeted disabilities, this past May in Washington, D.C., we held a national People with Targeted Disabilities conference. We brought in disability leaders from across the country. We brought in managers from the Federal Aviation Administration, and we brought in employees, and we brought in human resource and civil rights specialists. to discuss strategies that we could implement to significantly increase the participation rate of people with targeted disabilities in our workforce. The main recommendation that came out of this conference was that we needed to increase accountability among hiring managers, among managers and officials who make hiring decisions, the people that are going to bring employees on board. As a result, we in FAA, from that conference and that main recommendation of increasing accountability, we at the FAA decided to implement a strategic initiative in our yearly strategic plan. Now, I want to tell you that the FAA, unlike most other federal agencies, we're a pay-for-performance agency. So we have a strategic plan we implement every year that every employee in the agency, their performance plans are tied to that strategic plan. And how much their salaries are going to go up each year is dependent on how successful we are in accomplishing the goals of the strategic plan, as well as our individual performance. Now, that said, we implemented an initiative in our strategic plan that requires all of the heads of our lines of business and staff organizations to report to the administrator of FAA on a monthly basis the actions that they are taking to support hiring of people with targeted disabilities. So the heads of the major organizations, like, for example, our air traffic organization or our aviation safety organization, are required to report to the head of FAA on a monthly basis what they're doing to support hiring of people with targeted disabilities. We think that this accountability initiative is very important and critical to changing the participation rate for the better for people with targeted disabilities. We have several outreach initiatives towards the targeted disability community to support the work we're doing in increasing the participation rate. For example, we have just established a contract with Bender Consulting Services. How many people, by applause, has anybody heard of Bender Consulting Services? Great. I'm thrilled to know that. So we have established a recruiting contract with Bender Consulting Services. Basically, they will be doing searches for us for qualified candidates with targeted disabilities and advancing resumes. There's also options in the contract that allow managers to do an executive search through Bender Consulting for a person with a targeted disability. In addition, we also have a contract to hire mechanism where the employees would work for Bender for 6 months and then upon successful performance be converted to a full-time FAA employee. So that is a great initiative, which we are very excited about to have that contract, because we believe that that will help to increase employment opportunities and bring more people with targeted disabilities on board. The Bender Consulting Services is very connected to this community. In fact, I have two vacancies on my team, and we're one of the first teams using the Bender contract to recruit for the two vacancies on my team. So I'm very excited and hope that we can bring some great qualified people with targeted disabilities onto my team. In addition, we have partnerships with national organizations like the American Association for People with Disabilities. We also have partnerships with state and local rehabilitation agencies throughout the nation. And we are using the Workforce Recruitment Program for college students with disabilities. The Department of Labor each year provides a database of over 1,200 of the top college students with disabilities nationwide. And we share that with our managers and hiring officials so that they can use it in searching for qualified candidates with targeted disabilities. Finally, the final outreach initiative I want to mention is that we're establishing and we hope to launch by next spring an FAA disability website. We don't have the URL yet, where this is in the very beginning creation stages, but we will certainly share it with your organization contacts once we have the site up and running. But it's going to be a one-stop site for people with disabilities who want to work at the FAA. They can get all the information on non-competitive hiring authorities, what sort of documentation they need to have, and so forth. So we're going to have some great information on that site, and the site is going to be usable for our managers who want to hire people with targeted disabilities so they know how to reach out to that community. So we're very excited. Again, we do seek to become a model employer for people with targeted disabilities. We really know that this is a largely untapped pool of talent. We know that there is a very high unemployment rate out there, and we know that these are folks who really want to work, who are highly skilled and highly dedicated, and that's the type of person we need working for the federal government. And I have to tell you, as an individual with a targeted disability myself, I have been working for the federal government since 1995, and it has been a fantastic experience for me. I started as an entry-level employee and worked my way up into management. Part of the reason that I've done so well, of course, is I worked hard. I worked really hard, but I had the great support of managers who always ensured I had my accommodations in place and that I had opportunities to go to training and to advance. So the federal government, I think, is a great place to work. Also at FAA, we have a disability resource center for the provision of accommodations like assistive technology. They provide the Zoom text that I use on my computer. So we have a lot of great resources, and we hope you will take a look at FAA and consider applying for jobs and coming to work with us, because I got to tell you, it is a great place to work. We work really hard. It's good for people with type A personalities, but it's a fun place to work, and it's just an honor to be a public servant working at the FAA. So that is what I want to say about employment opportunities, and at the end of my presentation, I'll be happy to take questions on that, as well as what I'm about to discuss with regard to the Air Carrier Access Act. Now, the Air Carrier Access Act, I'm going to be, in my presentation today, speaking generally to the provisions of the Air Carrier Access Act, as well as to a new rule that's going to be implemented on May 13th, 2009, that impacts people who use service animals, as well as people with severe vision and hearing disabilities. So that's going to be important, and I'll talk about that and be happy to take questions. I want to start with the general provisions of what the Air Carrier Access Act means and how it works. So the Air Carrier Access Act sets out procedures that ensure that people with disabilities have the same right as anyone else to enjoy a pleasant flight. It prohibits discrimination in air travel on the basis of disability. It prohibits anyone with a disability from being denied access to air travel. Now, the Air Carrier Access Act says that you cannot be, by an airline, you cannot be required to have an attendant or to provide a medical certificate. So in general, there are some limited circumstances, but beyond those limited circumstances, a person with a disability cannot be required to have an attendant or to provide a medical certificate by an airline. Now, again, as I said, there are some limited circumstances where an attendant might be required or medical documentation might be required, and I'll speak to those a little bit later in my presentation. The Air Carrier Access Act requires that airlines provide assistance to people with disabilities with boarding, deplaning, and making connections. That includes personnel from the airlines providing assistance as well as providing equipment. So if you are a person who might have some mobility issues and need assistance getting from making a connection from one gate to another, the airlines would be required to have personnel assist you get from gate to gate, but also maybe to provide an electric cart or a wheelchair. The Air Carrier Access Act requires that people with vision and hearing disabilities have timely access to the same information as other passengers who are on the plane or in the airport. So if a flight is going to be delayed and, you know, it's on that board that most of us can't see, they I have to be on top, you know, literally on top of the board just barely to read it. They have to be making an announcement verbally letting you know that the flight has been delayed. The same information, again, that's provided visually to all other passengers, both in the airport or on the plane, has to be provided in a timely manner to people with vision disabilities. Now, the emergency exit row. Individuals sitting in the emergency exit row must be able to perform certain evacuation-related functions. So it's important to state that, you know, you have to be able to follow directions, be able to open the emergency exit door. There are specific FAA regulations on this. I'm not going to get into the details because it would be somewhat lengthy for this presentation, but we can certainly refer anybody that wants more information on that. But that's, again, for the emergency exit row, must be able to perform certain evacuation-related functions, and that's very important to know. Now, also very important, general provision from the Air Carrier Access Act. Airlines may not charge for services that are required under the Air Carrier Access Act. So if someone tells you that you're going to be charged for having assistance getting from one gate to another, that's not correct. They cannot charge you for services that are required under the Air Carrier Access Act. Airlines are also required to have a specially trained complaint resolution official who can address issues that come up related to the Air Carrier Access Act. So if you have a concern, if you feel like you are not being treated appropriately or correctly, and that the Air Carrier Access Act allows for you to be treated better or to have what the type of assistance that you're requesting, ask to speak with the official who's responsible for air carrier access issues, because airlines are required to have a specially trained official who handles these complaints. The airlines are also required to have a copy of the rule that implements the Air Carrier Access Act. So if you for some reason want to find out more specifically about what the requirements of the rule are while you're traveling, you can ask them to produce a copy of the rule. Now, I want to speak to service animals, and especially with regard to some of the new requirements and changes that will occur with the new rule that will take place on May 13th of 2009. First of all, what's very important for everyone to know is that so long as you and your service animal are not obstructing an aisle or other route for evacuation, in general, you should not be asked by the airline to be reseated. So the main reason for, or really the only reason for which an individual using a service animal should be asked if they could be reseated is if the animal is blocking the aisle or other route of evacuation. What I think, to really put this in simple terms for you, what it comes down to is safety. And I'm going to get into some other examples of where you wouldn't be asked to be reseated, but how that would be handled. What it comes down to is safety, and so long as the aisle or other routes for evacuation are not being obstructed, you should not be asked to be reseated. That said, if there is a safety reason and they need to reseat you, they should make every possible effort to reseat you and the animal so that you and the animal can be together for the flight. If for some reason they are not able to reseat you and the animal together, the airline should offer you, at no additional cost to you, the option to travel on a later flight or potentially for the animal to fly in the cargo hold. But again, every option should be exercised to reseat you. And again, if they ask you to fly on a later flight or so forth, there should be no additional charge to you. Cultural or religious objections are not a reason to reseat an individual who uses a service animal. So if someone has a cultural or religious objection to sitting near someone who uses a service animal, that is not an appropriate reason for the airline to reseat the individual who uses a service animal. And again, you'll hear me emphasize this a lot. Only if there is a direct threat to safety that can be demonstrated would reseating of the person with the service animal occur. It's also important to note that if someone claims that they have an allergy to the service animal, like an allergy to dogs, the person who has the allergies, the airline should make an attempt to reseat that person. If for some reason the person is claiming severe, like they're going to have a terrible asthma attack and there's no way to control it, the airlines may do what's called make a disability neutral decision, where they decide, okay, where they work to determine who's got a, like, say if some one of the two people has a connection first or somebody has to be to a meeting, it's really decided on those factors, on disability neutral. But those, again, circumstances should be very rare. And again, if somebody claims that they have an allergy, what they should do, usually it's pretty minor, and they should reseat the person with the allergy away from where the person using the service animal is. Now, I want to talk for a moment about, I mentioned earlier, there are some limited circumstances in which the airlines can require documentation, and also a limited circumstance in which the airline can require notice for use of a service animal. That's when we're talking about emotional support or psychiatric support animals. The airlines may require 48 hours notice under the new rule related to service animals. They may require 48 hours notice so that they can request medical documentation and substantiate the need for the emotional support or psychiatric support animal. That's one of those limited circumstances where they may require medical documentation for a service animal. Now, foreign carriers are only required to carry service dogs. It's important to note that foreign carriers who have routes that begin or end in a U.S. airport are covered by the requirements and a rule of the Air Carrier Access Act, but foreign carriers are only required to carry service dogs. Now, a harness or a vest on an animal without a credible verbal assurance is another limited circumstance in which the airline may request medical documentation. If someone has a harness or a vest on what the airline perceives to be a pet and they cannot obtain a credible verbal assurance from the passenger that the individual that the animal is a service animal, then the airline may request medical documentation. Again, these circumstances should be very limited, but I think we're all aware that there are individuals who may try to get their pet to travel for free by putting a vest, or unfortunately. So we need to... Oh, sure. Sorry. Okay. So the... again, requesting documentation for service animals should be limited. I mentioned the examples that, you know, if there's not a credible verbal assurance, and again, on the emotional support or psychiatric support animals, the airlines can request 48 hours notice that the person wants to fly with the emotional support animal, and also request documentation to substantiate the need. This is important because service animals in training are not covered by the Air Carrier Access Act under the new rule. So service animals in training are not covered because they're still in training, so they're not yet service animals. So that is an important distinction to be made. Now, I want to talk about briefly here the impact of the new rule for people with severe vision and hearing disabilities, people, for example, who are deafblind. A safety assistant may be required if effective communication for each flight segment cannot be established. Remember again, at the beginning of my presentation, I said in limited circumstances, an attendant may be required. Here's an example of a limited circumstance. But if, say, the person is deafblind and the airline cannot establish effective communication for each flight segment, then they may require that an attendant fly with the individual. This is important because the FAA, we require that a safety briefing be conducted at the beginning of each flight. So it's not just going to be effective communication, say, for the first flight. It has to be demonstrated there can be effective communication for each flight segment. This is important for those of us with vision disabilities as part of the new rule. Websites. How many people, by applause, have trouble with access to websites from time to time? Yeah. It's really challenging. Has everybody heard of Section 508? Yeah. I wish the private sector that their websites would be Section 508 compliant, but we're not there yet. So it is challenging. If an airline website is not accessible to you as a person with a vision disability, and you call their call center to make a reservation, as an example, because the website's not accessible, they cannot charge you for using the call center under the new rule. So if the $10 or $15 fee or whatever it is, if you can't access their website, they need to provide that service to you for free. Same goes if there are discounts only provided on the website, but you can't access the website, they need to make those same discounts available to you if you're calling for a reservation. Okay. I again want to emphasize that information that's available to all other passengers, that same information both in the airport and on the plane, must be made accessible in a timely manner to people with vision or hearing disabilities. Kiosks. I'm sure we're all familiar with the self-serve kiosks, and I think eventually it's going to come down to a day where there's nobody behind the counter, but they're all self-serve. No, hopefully it won't come down to that, but those kiosks can be challenging for those of us with vision disabilities. And under there's going to be a proposal for a new rule out there next year, but in the meantime, on the kiosk issue and the access to kiosk issue, but in the meantime, people with vision disabilities or people who can't access those kiosks must be given equal access. So if you can't use that self-serve kiosk, either you need to be brought to the front of the line and the individual behind the counter needs to help you with getting checked in, or an airline personnel member of the airline personnel should come to the kiosk with you and help you to work with the touchscreen and get the ticket. So that should definitely be occurring. There, as I mentioned, there's going to be a new notice for proposed rule issued next year, and there will be an opportunity to comment on that proposed rule. So I want to talk to you a little bit about how to contact the Department of Transportation if you have a complaint with regard to air carrier access. First of all, you can make a complaint directly to the airline with which you are traveling, but you can also make a complaint to our Air Consumer Protection Division, which is in the Office of the Secretary of Transportation, the Aviation Enforcement Office of Aviation Enforcement and Proceedings. I'm going to give you a phone number, which is 202-366-2220. Again, that number is 202-366-2220. That's the Office of Aviation Enforcement and Proceedings, where you can file a complaint regarding air carrier access with the Department of Transportation. Also, I want to give you a website that is, which is http://airconsumer.ost.dot.gov, and that's a website where you can find out more about the Air Carrier Access Act and the complaint process. So I have there, with that, I have provided you with a very general overview of the requirements, I hope with some important information with regard to the use of service animals, with regard to traveling if you have a vision disability, and what the Air Carrier Access Act calls for. And I want to say I'll be happy to take as many questions as you have in a few minutes. I also have cards with me that I'll be happy to share with people after the event. I don't have Braille, but I do have large print on the back of my cards. I also want to give you the name of an individual in my office, the National People with Disabilities Program Manager, who works on my staff, who, if you want to find out more about employment with FAA, you can contact this person. Her name is Kimberly Castillo, C-A-S-T-I-L-L-O, and her phone number is 202-385-8130. Again, 202-385-8130, and that's about employment opportunities at the FAA. And, of course, you can always call me about that or the Air Carrier Access Act, and I'll be happy to help you as well. So at this time, I'd be glad to take any questions.
Okay. With respect to questions, we have plenty of time. Just want to make an announcement now, and I'll make it again tonight, that we have plenty of wireless mics. Be just as easy if you just want to stand up in place at your chair. You don't have to go to the center aisle, and folks will come around and give you a mic. So we're going to do it.
Great. And I wanted to say, if for some reason I'm not able to answer your question, I'll take it back and get you an answer. I'll give you my card and be able to get you an answer.
And if they won't, the FAA can fly me back to wherever they want me to go, and I'll get you an answer.
There you go.
Okay. My name is Andy Baracco. I'm a vocational specialist with the VA, and I'm wondering just now, I assume that blind people would not be welcome to apply for positions as air traffic controllers, but other than that, what kinds of jobs would be available for people with disabilities and perhaps blind people in particular?
Okay, great. Thank you. That's a great question. Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right. Blind people would not be able to be air traffic controllers. I will say, though, that in my job earlier this year, I had the great pleasure of visiting one of our en route centers and got hooked up, as they say, to the verbal system so that I could hear, you know, the air traffic controllers giving instructions to the pilots, and gave my family a little scare when I got home and said, you know, oh, guess what? I was an air traffic controller for a day. No, not really. Just yeah, you're absolutely right. The way that the types of jobs we have, there are medical requirements for air traffic controllers. That doesn't mean that all people with targeted disabilities are automatically excluded from being an air traffic controller. Obviously, those with vision or other sensory disabilities would be excluded from being an air traffic controller. We do have individuals who use wheelchairs who are controllers, and in fact, individuals who use wheelchairs who are controller air traffic controller managers. So not everybody's excluded. Also, our aviation safety inspectors, probably those with vision disabilities, wouldn't be able to do that kind of job. That said, we have lots of general federal positions, like accounting positions, or what we call, you said you work for the VA, so I'm sure you're familiar with program and management analyst positions at our headquarters office in Washington, D.C. and throughout the country. We have equal employment opportunity positions. We have human resource positions. We have administrative positions. We have we employ approximately 44,000 people nationwide, so we're a very large employer, and not everything that we do. Obviously, our mission is aerospace transportation and ensuring the most safest, efficient aerospace transportation system in the world, but we obviously have lots of positions that support the overall functioning of the agency. So, like any other federal agency, we have a lot of positions for which individuals with vision disabilities could apply.
Hi, this is John Ross. I have a question. Talking about service animals and emotional support animals, what is the law in regards to what defines an emotional support animal?
Okay, what would be required is that medical documentation would have to be provided from a licensed professional, like a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a social worker, that indicates that because of an emotional or psychiatric condition, the person traveling needs the service dog for emotional or psychiatric support. And again, just to reiterate what I stated before, under the new rule, the airlines can request 48 hours notice when a person is traveling with emotional or psychiatric support animals so that they can review the documentation and substantiate the need. Sure.
Hi, if a plane goes down, you're generally toast, but if there are...
Dirk, you certainly hit the nail on the head with that one.
But occasionally one hears of survivors. What's the best seat in the plane to maximize the probability of survival?
That's one of those questions I don't have the answer to. I do.
Yeah. Speaker has the answer. The next plane would be the correct answer.
Hi, I'm Mike Keekley. I noticed you said that when you make telephone reservations that you do not have to pay the surcharge. The last time I made reservations with United, they wanted me to pay the surcharge. So how do you tell them that you're disabled and you shouldn't have to pay the surcharge?
Well, and again, the requirement that there be no surcharge is under the new rule that's going to take effect on May 13th, 2009. So that rule is not in effect yet, and I'm sorry if I wasn't clear about that when I was making the presentation. But I would suggest, stating clearly that you have a vision disability and that you cannot use the website, and therefore you understand they're required not to charge you. And if they still charge you after the rule goes into place, you can contact the Air Consumer Protection Division and register a complaint.
Hey, if I might, I'd like to make a comment. You were saying that dogs in training are not service animals, so they don't have consideration. We need the best trainers we can get for our service animals, and I think that is a potential disservice to the service animals because they need all the experience they can get.
Yeah, I appreciate the comment.
Okay, I have two questions. This is Maria. Okay, am I close enough now? I sound okay. First question is, what about those of us who travel with canes? Do we have some specific protocol on that? I have personally taken to just walking through the security with the cane and telling them, I'll send it back and you can look at it. That seems to work, but that's because nobody else seemed to know what they were doing, and I wasn't going to allow myself to be manhandled by your security people. Okay, that's one question.
Okay, let me address that question for you, because I can address that relatively quickly, and then we'll get to your second question. That, if you're talking about screening through security at the airport, that comes under the Transportation Security Administration,
okay,
not the FAA. But what I will tell you is that there is a screening of people with disabilities program at the Transportation Security Administration, and I'll give you my card offline, and I can, you know, if you send me an email, I can connect you with the person who's in charge of that, who can address any concerns that you have about the screening issue, security screening. Second question.
Okay, this is even more narrowly focused, but I'll ask you anyway. You said that we have the protection of being able to call to make our reservations if we find the computer sites to be inaccessible. I was wondering if that's applicable also to those who are eligible to have special services under the employment and the families of employment in certain airlines. Or do you even know that?
I don't think I know that. I'm not sure.
Okay,
I understand
that's fine.
The question.
I just thought,
sorry,
I'd ask.
Okay.
My question regards wheelchairs. Many times I have flown and they have forced me into a wheelchair, and I have been on a 3-hour flight and I don't want to sit anymore. I want to walk. Is there any way that I can gracefully tell them, you know, I would rather be transported on foot?
Okay, so let me make sure I understand, because I can't see you from here. So you're a person who does not use a wheelchair. You are able to walk.
Correct.
Correct? Okay,
mm-hmm.
So, and you have a vision disability.
I'm totally blind.
Totally blind. They cannot require you to use a wheelchair. You should tell them that you are able to walk, and you simply need assistance getting from one gate to the next or from
right.
the gate to
the next. Right. I always do, and most of the time they're really good. But a couple of times they have told me, you are required to use a wheelchair if you have a disability, and that's that.
No, that's not true. And what I would suggest to you is, if that occurs, ask to speak with the airline complaint official for Air Carrier Access Act. And if they're not able to resolve it for you, of course, you can always contact the office that I mentioned and register a complaint.
Thank you.
I'm Vivian Younger, and I travel all the time. I live here, but I work up in San Jose. And a lot of times they want to put me and the guide dog in the front by the bulkhead. And I tell them, no, that's not where I want to sit. What is the thinking behind that?
I think the thinking, I try a little bit to get inside the head of the airlines here a little bit. I think the thinking behind the bulkhead seating is that there's more room for you and the animal. I believe that's their thinking about it. But, you know, going back to what I was saying at the beginning about, as long as that the you and the animal, as long as there's no obstruction of the aisle or any other evacuation route, you can't be restricted on where you can sit.
Okay, thank you.
Nobody else.
Sorry about that, guys. This is Andrea Pitzenbarger from Orange County. I just want to address Mar's question about the wheelchair. I travel a lot, and sometimes I have had to be extremely insistent that I do not need a wheelchair. I do not have to use one. The only times I use it is if I have to change planes and I'm in a hurry. Sometimes it's easier to go that way. But if I'm getting off a plane, no. You do not have to use one. And I've had people tell me, and most of the time when they say you have to, it's because they don't speak English well. And somebody's told them somewhere along the line that if a person's disabled, they bring a wheelchair. Well, that's just nonsense. And the other thing is, I've been told by airline clerks that, oh, we just put that in so you'll get help. You know, we write wheelchair because that's the easiest way to make sure you get help. Well, that's silly, too, because if you don't need it, and somebody else may need it. Mm-hmm. So that's just, I just want to share that you really have to be pretty insistent sometimes, particularly if there's a language barrier, because a lot of the people who work in airports are non-native English speakers, and they just assume, and you just have to make sure they know, no, I don't need a wheelchair, I can walk.
Hi, this is Frank Wealthy. Just before I ask my question, a very quick comment. Wheelchairs make wonderful carry-on luggage carriers. But to my question, it's sort of similar in that, although I haven't had this happen recently just because I haven't traveled there, Chicago in the past has been notorious for taking people with disabilities to a holding room between flights. What's the FAA position on that?
That's the first that I've heard of that.
It's infamous in the blind community.
I'm sorry?
It's well known in the blind community.
Okay. Well, that is the first that I have heard of that, but certainly I will take that back and look at that. I mean, really, the type of assistance, especially if you're making a connection, and I fly through Chicago a lot, and we all know that O'Hare in particular is a very large and can be difficult airport, but it's just about getting from one gate to another. I'd never heard of that, but certainly I'll look into that issue.
Not only do they take you to a holding area, they take your ticket away from you, like you're not capable of holding your own ticket.
Oh, my goodness.
And they have been the cause of us missing flights because of the way they function.
Because why? I'm sorry?
Pardon?
They caused missing flights?
Caused us to miss our flight because they took us there.
That's shocking. Let's talk about that offline. I'm really just surprised.
My name is Ramona Craig from East LA. My question, or my concern, is not really a question. I fly out of Denver quite frequently, and I fly as early as possible. My concern is that there hasn't been help to find the gate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I've noticed that only with Denver. My question is, what can I do in the future to secure that when I get to point A or point B, like Denver, and that if it's 5 o'clock in the morning and I'm taking the first flight out, and you know how you have to be at the airport an hour and a half before,
right.
What can I do to ensure that there's going to be some kind of help? I'm going to fly out of Houston, Texas, like at 6 a.m.
Okay, let me restate the question so everybody heard it, make sure, because I think some people in the back didn't hear the question. The question was, when she's traveling, she's stating that sometimes, especially when she has early flights, that there's not airline personnel to provide assistance with getting to the gate. It sounds like at Denver and possibly at some other airports. And what I would suggest, a couple things. One is contact the airline in advance of the flight and let them know that you're going to need some assistance upon arrival at the airport to get to the gate. And if you don't get the appropriate assistance when you get there, make sure that you ask the airline personnel to speak with the complaint resolution official who deals with air carrier access issues and register your complaint. And you can also register a complaint with the Department of Transportation.
If a person were to apply for a position as a reservation operator, or if you get the training and everything like that, can you be in your area? Like, say, if I were to apply for a position, would I be able to work in the LA area, or would I automatically be transferred to wherever?
Well, you're asking about an airline employment issue, and I don't know I don't work for the airlines, so I don't know the answer to that question. Be happy to talk to you about federal employment, because we are trying to get more people with disabilities to come to work for the federal government.
Hi, Jerry Consler. Is the points available, or the ranking for one who is disabled and one who is a veteran, used to be the same? Is there a special ranking or points available for someone in the so-called targeted disability group?
That is a great question, and let me let me try to be as clear as I can on this. There are rankings for veterans with disabilities up to, I believe it's up to a 10-point veteran ranking for veterans with disabilities. And a 10-point veteran with a disability would most likely be a person with a targeted disability, because to have that 10-point ranking, you have to have a pretty severe disability. That said, when we're talking about targeted disabilities, there is no ranking on the application. In other words, there's no particular preference for a person with a targeted disability, whereas there is a preference for veterans and for veterans with disabilities. But the federal government and FAA in particular has a non-competitive hiring authority for people with targeted disabilities. You may be familiar with the term Schedule A, which the federal government as a whole uses. We at FAA, we have our own personnel system. You heard me mention early in my presentation, we're pay for performance, so we're not the typical GS 1 through 15. We're in pay bands and we're on our own separate personnel system. So we use an authority called on-the-spot hiring, which is a non-competitive authority. So if you have a targeted disability, you submit your resume, you're qualified for a position, I want to hire you, I can end the competitive process and bring you on board if you're qualified. So that is a way to get people with targeted disabilities on board faster through the non-competitive process. Schedule A and all other federal agencies on the spot at FAA.
Okay. Well, we want to thank John Bennison. What a wealth of knowledge, huh? Great presentation. Thank you very much for coming out here. Hope you have a nice stay at the convention.
Thank you.
Certainly been rewarded by your presence. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I don't know if you'll be able to hang out in the back and talk to folks, I would hope. But
sure, yeah. Absolutely.
Great. Okay, and we will certainly correspond about this holding area problem. It is indeed an ongoing problem, and it's been one for a long time, really. Okay. You know, those of you who know me well will certainly admit that I don't give a lot of love to Southern California. See? Well, that's just the truth. I'm not going to say something that isn't, you know, true. But, true enough out there? True enough, Mr. Pomerantz? Yeah, that's true. And that's right. But our next speaker, I have to give a great deal of love to California, because Terry Grossman, through her work down here, they are so lucky to have her. She does an outstanding job with Audio Description Los Angeles. The people that talk about her do so in such glowing ways, both of her love of her work and her professionalism as a writer, as a trainer, and as a describer, and as someone who just is the whole package for what she provides through Audio Description Los Angeles, the plays she has done, and the many other things. Instead of reading the long bio, I'm much rather give as much time as possible to Terry to present us with a progress report from the California Audio Describers Alliance. Please hear it for Terry Grossman.
Thank you. Is this mic working well? Can you all hear me?
Yeah, you're good.
Okay, good. Excuse me. At a previous fall convention here at CCB, a group of us, describers from California, had worked for over a year on standards. We believe deeply that the best description is standards-based description, in which we are all working toward the same end with the same tools. And we were able at that last convention to adopt our standards, which if you are having trouble sleeping, I'd be happy to email them to you. They run 12 pages with footnotes, so, you know, we'll have a sign-up sheet in case you're interested. But this is a little like getting people from the NFB and the AFB in the same room at the same time, and they're not being bloodshed as a result. Describers have been trained in different ways. There's a group of describers in Northern California who do an entirely different way of working than I do here in Southern California, having been trained by someone who was trained by the Fansteels, who some of you may know. So this was a big deal to get these standards adopted. This was huge. We had been told that there had been previous meetings of describers in which people almost came to blows over issues of description, if you can imagine. So this was a huge step forward in a collegial effort to all be on the same page. Subsequent to that, these same standards have been adopted by a national group. This is the Audio Description Coalition. And they have their founders from Connecticut, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Texas, California, and Washington, D.C. And they have taken our standards as a starting point, and they have revised and expanded them. And if you were to really have insomnia, you could read them both side by side with your screen reader, and you would find an enormous similarity in the two. And we are now so pleased to be broadening a standards-based quality description across the country. So this is a huge deal for us, and we're very pleased with that. The web address for the Audio Description Coalition is audiodescriptioncoalition.org. So if you'd like to look it up, you can go on their website and look at their standards as well. Additionally, we provided, California Audio Describers Alliance provided our standards to the American Federation of the Blind for their use in developing description standards for educational materials as part of a U.S. Department of Education grant awarded to the Described and Captioned Media Program with the National Association for the Deaf. So we are reaching out with our standards to even greater parties and being part of the process of developing quality description throughout the world. And we're really very, very pleased about that. And it was unexpected because many people told us we couldn't, you know, stay in the same room together. But we proved them wrong. Earlier this year, we were very pleased to be up with Jeff. Up in Sacramento area, in which we held an introduction and overview of audio description for about 15 people up in Sacramento. And so we are hopeful that this is going to lead to further actual training for folks, which takes about 2.5 to 3 days. And then they would be mentored through a process of becoming trained and professional describers. So that's a very exciting thing on the horizon that we still have in hopes. Jeff is applauding over here. Work continues by all of the describers, Northern California, Southern California, San Diego. We are hoping to bring some Santa Barbara describers into the fold and hope to add some new describers in Sacramento. So we're very pleased about that. The Rose Parade, which is dear to my heart, will once again be streamed on the web from the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service on their site at LARS, LARRS.org. You'll be able to go on the homepage, and there will be a button that you don't need a password for, and you click the button, and you can stream a live description of the Tournament of Roses Rose Parade live from Pasadena. So I want to have you all listening because I will be up there at the crack of dawn, freezing to death. You will be home in your jammies and fuzzy slippers with mimosas. The bathroom right over there and the mimosa. Even more, I can't drink coffee because I can't get to the bathroom and back in time. So, so I want you to appreciate the sacrifice I'm making for all of you. So I want you to listen. So I hope you can enjoy that. If you're Southern Californians or if you're down here for the Rose Parade, there are limited numbers of seats live at the parade route, which is a very cool thing to do. You do have to get up at the crack of dawn to do this. I will warn you. But they do have coffee and donuts and their own bathroom on site. So this is pretty cool.
Nice.
Yes, very nice. Very nice. So that's coming up. We are also, some of the describers with the coalition are advising the Universal Studios Orlando on their accessibility plan. So this is very exciting. They are actually thinking about making the park accessible to more folks. So we're really excited about the possibilities in the future for that more accessibility. We'll keep you posted on what's going on there. And if you're in Orlando, we would remind you that the Blue Man Group at Orlando Universal is described every performance. So if you're ever in Orlando, do go to see the Blue Men. They're a lot of fun. They're a lot of fun, and you can enjoy the description. We are also in discussions with XM and Sirius Radio for the possibility of adding some audio-described content to satellite radio. So that could be very cool as well. So that's what's up with us. And we are continuing our work down here at the Center Theater Group. And something that sounds cool to me, because I would get to talk to you and do description for you, is trying to work out a description event for you with your conference. But your conference is so full. I'm exhausted just reading it, much less trying to attend even a third of what is available here, all of which is very important. Show of hands, would a Thursday night description, if we could pull that off, be something that would be appealing? Okay. All right. Well, Jeff and I will be in discussion for next time and see if we can get one of the Center Theater Group theaters involved, if they've got something going that we can dovetail. Does that sound like fun? Okay.
I'd be happy to skip the board meeting, personally.
Now, I wouldn't want to cause problems down here with you guys. You got to do your board meeting. So, no. Okay. All right. In lieu of board meeting, we will all convene at the Kirk Douglas Theater in Culver City then. Okay. Well, thank you all. Thank you all for having me. If you have any questions, I will take some questions. Penny Fraser back there, I can see.
Well, this is Rosemary Dobbs. I was wondering, what kind of things are you working on with XM and Sirius? Movies or what? We don't have to see to.
No, isn't that cool? You don't have to see it. So that would be the thing, is we would give them described movies,
yeah,
and you could listen to them on the radio. Is that cool?
Yeah,
yeah.
That would be
okay.
Neat.
And yeah, that's exactly what's under discussion. So we'll keep you posted about that.
NASCAR?
Wow, I don't have any
blood
NASCARs.
And guts person out there.
I'm in. You know, it makes for interesting description, though, with the alcohol thing. You know, it gets, you know, the rules don't quite get followed as precisely as they should with the beer. But I like the sentiment right there. Okay, who's next? Anna?
Hello, yeah. This is Steve Ford. What was the first website that you mentioned? I think you said audiodescribers.com.
Audio Description Coalition, one
Coalition.
Word. Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I was actually going to ask, I know that you know, you do the scripts for the Rose Parade and all of that. Is that you that does all of those as well? And I guess my question is, all of that is done just beautifully. Is there any way that we can get more of that read on the feed when you do the Rose Parade description? Because they really are beautiful descriptions that are put together.
Thank you. That's very nice. One of the things that we have done in the past, let me go back a little bit. We were originally doing this just on the radio on site. We expanded to television on the SAP. We lost our television coverage because that station decided not to cover the Rose Parade at all. So we were done. Oh. So I said, you know what we should be doing? To heck with these TV people who are so snobby and think we're just radio, so we don't count. Let's stream this on the web. So that has actually been our focus of streaming on the web. I think it's not impossible that we couldn't pre-record these maybe and get them podcast someplace. I will tell you that the script is done on the 30th. It's finished on the 30th. And I'll tell you why. We are given a website with a password, and we go on, and they have a little artist rendering of the float. It's in color and everything. And so we look at that, and we write a preliminary description from that. And we try to keep it. The floats go by in about, it's like you see them maybe 2.5 minutes. So we can't, we have to keep it tight. So we do that. Then about 3 or 4 days before the parade, several of us take our little scripts and we physically go and look at the floats. And we look at it and we sometimes say, what are you talking about? That is not a bear, it's a dog. Additionally, we find that the designers exercise their creative juices by saying, no, no, take the blue off. It's all wrong. It has to be red. And so we have come up with, you know, a lovely sky blue something, and now it's not sky blue when you look up. So we have to make those corrections. When we're there, we see detail we don't get to see. But I will tell you that a lot of the material is not on the float when we see them then. Okay? So then we take all those written things and we go back. This is Terry again, suffering for you.
Sure.
I spend all day to get those corrections done. That evening I get all the corrections in, and then the scripts go to these several people who need them, because we have two description teams. We have one description team that's at the front of the parade that sees the parade from the home and garden viewpoint, which is right at the front of the parade at Orange Grove in Colorado. There's a second team of describers at the on-site location down at the Paseo Pasadena, where there's another group of people. Well, what I'm saying at 8:03 is not there for 20 more minutes. It takes 20 minutes for the parade to go from that point. So that's we have two sets of describers. So we get the script to the other set of describers. Everybody then has an opportunity to bone up on the strange language from the float that came from wherever. Yeah, so that's how we do that. But we will make an effort to see if we can't get this material. No, you don't hear enough of the description? Okay. I will include that in the script, and we'll see if we can be a little more in-depth with the description. So, okay. And we'll see if we can't get it available to you. Maybe we could do it. We could certainly load it in print, and you could read it yourselves. Getting it recorded in time for the parade, I don't know is going to be feasible. But we can try. But I will take that back to the powers that be. Another question?
I got a question.
Yes.
Yeah, this is Penny. In relation to the upcoming HD television.
Yes.
Are you going to be working with that? And is there ways that you're going to be able to have a way to describe things for HD television and also for DVDs?
Two separate issues. The HD TV issue, there are people working on the standards for HD TV that have been doing heroic duty to try to get a dedicated channel that would be devoted to description. So, for instance, you would have a dedicated channel that would be Spanish language, for instance, which, of course, in California makes perfect sense.
Awesome.
They're trying to get one for audio description. The success they've had, I am uncertain of. I haven't heard people shouting and screaming in the aisles that this has been achieved, but they are certainly trying. So that's that. The DVD situation is an entirely different circumstance. We have been told when we ask people why they're not including something that has already been described, not necessarily by me, but by somebody, to include it on their DVD. And they will tell us, A, there's no money, and B, there's no space. There's no space. I don't know that that's the case. I'm not the technological wonder, so I'm hesitant to say that they're wrong, but I'm also hesitant to say that they're right. I think there's an element of just not wanting to do it. So I think this is going to require a lot more agitation and a little more input from everybody that we want this done. The number of described DVDs in the United Kingdom, for instance, is a good deal larger than ours. I think it's, Rick, is it 20%? About 20% of the DVDs released in the United Kingdom have description on them. Just to give you a clue. The last one that was released in this country, Ricky? See? Okay. My point is made for me. We don't even remember. Okay? It's that. Yeah. It, you know, we're talking hen's teeth here. So, yeah. So, yeah. Ray. Ray was probably the last
one
that was released. So we have a lot of work to do there. Lots of work.
Yes. Mary Lou Baracco, I have a question. You said that a lot of times you go back and you look over the floats again, and this is not what it says. Have you ever had a time where a lot of the networks or different people know who you are, and you're looking at the floats and rewriting the description,
and somebody says, hey, can I look at your description? What they're giving us is not the right thing. And they said, hey, what are you looking at? Maybe we don't have that. And they compare notes with you. Have you ever had that situation that somebody's looking over your shoulder from a network or somebody, or are their descriptions totally different than what you get?
If you listen to what they say, we do get material designers. The float designers do write up something that we can use as a starting point. Sometimes it's really helpful. They do a good job of doing a description according to the rules. Other times it is 10,000 dendrobium orchids, which is nice, but I'm not going to count them. And when they go by, it's not at all clear that I'm going to know which one is the dendrobium orchid either. So we occasionally can use the material. We've had a couple. We do have some of the float designers who do know who we are, which is kind of encouraging. They got over the fact that I don't sign. That's a little stumbling block for them. No, I'm not a sign interpreter. No. It's for people with visual impairments. Oh, well, how do you do that? So then we explain a little bit, and that's how that goes. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Hello.
Who's got the mic? I'm sorry. Someone's pointing over here. Okay,
yes.
I'm sorry.
I certainly like to see some description at the opera.
Ah, my colleague, for some of you who may have been down here, J.C. O'Connell, J.C. Henning, she's also known as, is a huge opera buff. And she is continuing to agitate over at the opera to include opera. She will be magnificent if we can get in there. We are working on it. We will keep you posted.
The other thing, since you're doing the Rose Parade, there is a blind band from Ohio that's going to be marching.
This year?
Yes.
Next year? 2010. Oh, that is very cool. I have to tell you my guide dog story. This is several years ago. The guide dogs, please forgive me, the Guide Dogs of America, I believe it was, had a float in the Guide Dogs for the Blind. Okay, I stand corrected. Had a float in the parade, and I was broadcasting from Orange Grove in Colorado, and the float was coming for me. So I'm down on Orange Grove, so they're approaching that big corner where all the TV cameras are. Honestly, it broke down right in front of me. It broke down. They had to tow it away. It never made it on the television screen. It was awful. It was awful. And one of the first rules of description is you describe what you see. And this was a real struggle for me not to break that rule and say, I'm going to describe this float anyway because I've seen it. So we unfortunately didn't get to describe it. It was real disappointing. It was a very disappointing moment. Yeah, very disappointing. So
I think that Roger was trying to say, and Roger, if I'm wrong, you'll correct me, that Mary Watkins is going to talk about the HDTV thing tomorrow, potentially.
Oh, excellent.
Is that right, Roger?
Yeah. Oh, good.
Okay.
Excellent.
At 10:30, right.
Oh, good. We'll get more information.
Yeah. And I have a question as well.
So do I.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. I don't know if you were there back in 96 or not, but that's when I was freezing cold because my daughter was playing for Menachie High School that year, and they played in the band, in the parade. It was really fun.
And
you guys did a great
father.
Job.
You're a good father.
Oh, I tried to be anyway. But the funny thing was, I was trying to tell, I almost missed it because they didn't know how to pronounce the school name, and I couldn't tell anybody. It's Menachie, not Monash. You know?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes we get pronunciation guides in the material we get from the bands or from the float builders. Sometimes we don't, and so we do our best with that. Yes, Jeff.
You said, I think, that in order to access the Rose Parade description,
yes.
Which I think I'd get up early to do on New Year's, maybe I would.
Hey, you'll have to be there at 8 o'clock, okay?
Not a problem. I do that. Especially nowadays, I'm so old that, you know, we can stay up past 9:30, right?
I have great.
Well, that's
too.
Not true. At Joni's house, we do, so there is that. But anyway, you said that we had to have a password.
You do not have to have a password.
Oh, you don't?
You do not.
Okay.
You do not.
Great.
Yeah. There is a button. I think it says something about independence, and that's the button you're looking for. And that will be your passport to the Rose Parade.
My name is Henrietta Welch, and I am totally blind. And my question is, year before they had, because I got a low-frequency TV, because, you know, radio, because I'm blind, I can't see the picture.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the year before they had on Crown 4, this last year they didn't, they had on 36. But I didn't have an outreach antenna to get 36, so I ended up missing it. Is there any way you could talk to the networks of putting it on low frequency again so I can hear the whole thing and I won't have to miss it, you know, with the...
I will mention that to Jolie at Lars. Sometimes we are able to do a simulcast on KCSN in Southern California.
But I live in Northern California.
Okay, you live
Hayward.
In Northern California. Okay, I will mention that to Jolie and see if we can come up with a solution. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's on the internet. That's what the Lars thing will be streaming on the internet, if that's helpful to you.
Yeah. Hi. I probably should ask the lady tomorrow, but I really would. I know that there's not enough descriptive video on television at night, but I would like to see the soap operas be described. There are some visual things that we do not know that's going on, and I'd like to see that described.
Okay. Okay. Well, as the world turns, we'll see what we can do.
I have a follow-up question to that.
Okay.
I like to watch shows like CSI in Miami.
Yeah.
Which used to be audio described in the LA area. And one night I tuned in, and instead of getting audio description, I got Se Habla Español.
Yes.
Which helps me diddly squat because I don't speak Spanish.
Indeed. One of the problems is that the same channel that's used for, the SAP channel that's used for description is also used for Spanish language. And in certain communities, Spanish language trumps description because there are more viewers. They do have Spanish tangles. They have Telemundo and Univision. Yeah.
Any more questions?
Yeah, just one. If we do want to go to the Rose Parade,
yes.
How do we find our way to the audio description section to get seating?
If you will contact Lars, they can conceivably arrange transportation for you. You have to get up early and get to a collection point, but they've got a van that transports people back and forth. Yes. Okay.
Okay. Any more questions?
Yes. Is it still going to be on? Go ahead. Is it still going to be on 36 and Channel 4? Because the Rose Parade does a great job.
The Rose Parade on 36 and
four.
Channel 4?
Correct. NBC.
NBC. They do a nice job, but they say things like beautiful, and I'm not allowed to say that.
Channel 5 also be good.
Channel 5, that was our first approach to a television station because they show the parade from start to finish. They don't have commercials.
Yes.
And the problem with them is they were using their SAP for Spanish language. And so that was their preference. So that didn't work out.
Okay, so the problem is, though, they got the cotton ball, these ball games, and that's what's kind of hard because, you know, people miss the parade. So I'm willing to, you know.
Well, now let's not interfere with football now.
No,
you're getting close to the end.
But you guys do a good job.
Well, it's nice to see you have your priorities straight. Yes.
I was actually going to say that to get the information related to the Rose Parade, if the city of Pasadena has a number.
They do.
And that is area code 626-744-ROSE. And it will give you the information on the number. It's a recorded message. You can also email RGORS, as in Sam, KI, at cityofpasadena.net and ask for that information as well. That's a service that the city of Pasadena does provide, so you can do it that way. I don't know if all the seats are filled yet. People start making those reservations the beginning of October, so we're already kind of close to the end.
Yeah.
But you can go ahead and try it that way. And Pat, I don't know if you knew of another way. Yeah. So anyway, that's what we do. That's area code 626 844 Rose.
Okay, any last questions? Okay, I want to say before I say our goodbyes to Terry briefly, I want to say there really hasn't been a good soap opera since Mary Hartman bit the dust. Okay, isn't Terry a wonderful, wonderful pleasure to have down here? That's great. Okay, several announcements, and I'll probably forget a few. And I know I'll have you up here, Gabe, to make one. Somehow or other, even though it got on the internet, deleted from the program was the Constitutional and Bylaws meeting, which is in the Santa Cruz room right after this session. Jerry is ready. So right at 4:05 or whenever we adjourn, they will begin. We are going to have Dan will be giving his entire report tonight. We have enough time for that. We think we have the most attendance at tonight's session, and he's going to do his entire report tonight, which leaves us a little more time for some of these speakers today, and it works out well for all parties concerned. So be there for Dan's state and federal legislation report tonight. Dan, will you announce the URL to listen to the stream?
So the URL for ACB.org is you go to ACBradio.org, go down to announcements, and there should be a link because we saw it up there. If you can't find the link, then you go to http://radio.acb.org/9872. Okay, there'll be a test in about 2 minutes. Okay, do you want me to repeat that or not?
I think so.
http://radio.acb.org/9872.
Okay. Let's see. How many of you were out there listening to the quiet today of the hybrid car? Yes. That was certainly louder than the car, that's for sure. Well, we are very, very privileged to have with us. Well, this introduction may take a while. I can't say anything. We're very privileged to have with us Lawrence Rosenblum. Lawrence is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. Okay, I'm off here. Okay. He received his PhD from the University of Connecticut. He teaches in perceptual, cognitive, and introductory psychology and was the Patricia McSweeney Macaulay Chair in Teaching Excellence. Professor Rosenblum has published more than 40 journal articles and book chapters. I'm cutting in and out. On perceptual psychology. He conducts research on lip reading, multisensory integration, face perception, auditory approach, human echolocation, and perception of ambient acoustics. He has been the recipient of multiple National Science Foundation National Institute of Health grants for his research on lip reading and multimodal speech integration. He is on the editorial boards of multiple journals and has been on review panels for the National Institutes of Mental Health. His research has been reported in numerous newspapers, including the LA Times, and as well as other periodicals, as well as Discovery Channel. Most notably, he's done excuse me, in the area of quiet cars, and it is for that reason that we are here today, to hear from Mr. Rosenblum on this topic, which is of so much concern to each and every one of us. Dr. Rosenblum?
Thank you. Can you hear me? Yeah, good. Thank you for inviting me to talk about this important issue. I realize that some of you did get to experience a demonstration this morning of the audibility of quiet cars, but I thought I'd start off with one of our own demonstrations. The first thing you're going to hear is a 2004 Honda Accord passing a listener, or microphones in this case, at about 5 miles an hour. Sorry about that. Can we do something about the feedback? Or?
Not really.
Okay. Let me try that one more time. Yeah. Were you able to hear that okay? Okay. Here comes Prius now. This is a 2006 Toyota Prius that's going at 5 miles an hour, again passing the microphone at about 5 feet away. Want to hear it again? If you listen very carefully, you can hear some wind and some birds, but not a lot of car. So you're, I'm sure, all aware of this issue. What I'd like to do today is talk about some history of the issue, some general psychological research that bears on this issue, and this research actually suggests that hearing the approach of cars is an issue for all of us, not just individuals who are blind. And I'll talk a little bit about the research I've conducted in my own lab on exactly this question. So from when the first electric and prototype electric and hybrid cars were designed in Stanford in the 70s, scientists were aware of the problem, that they were so quiet, they were potentially dangerous. So when they were practicing with these cars around the Stanford campus, there were a number of incidents where people would not be able to hear them and were almost hit. And these were sighted students, mostly. And what they realized, and I think this is generally what we know now, that when a car is going less than 20 miles an hour, that there is not enough natural tire sound or aerodynamic sound to make it audible. Most of us use the sound of a car engine when it's that slow. When a car goes above that, there generally is enough tire sound and aerodynamic sound. So now as electric and hybrid cars are becoming more and more prevalent, I believe almost 1.5 million Priuses have been sold in America, anecdotes of near misses and some accidents have started to appear. And this has occurred for both blind individuals, these anecdotes, as well as sighted pedestrians, particularly people on bicycles. Now, there's a number of different contexts where this seems to be more of a problem. So, for example, in parking garages and parking lots where there's a lot of background sound, certainly at street corners where there's a lot of background car sound, and that's where a lot of these anecdotes seem to be occurring. And then some things have hit the popular press. There was recently, in May of this year, a situation where a young sighted boy was hit by a Prius going very slow. He was riding his bicycle. Not sure if you've heard of this one, but he was fine. I mean, he was scraped up a little bit, but it was pretty clear that this was an incident where he was hit. He didn't know that the car was coming because he was used to hearing cars. It was one of the few Priuses on his street, and it likely caused the accident. In terms of the hard statistics, though, it's still too early, and there's a number of reasons for that. It's still too early to determine if, in fact, quiet cars are more dangerous for us. I'm on an advisory board. I'm on a subcommittee of the Society of Automotive Engineers and have been in contact with folks at NHTSA. As it turns out, NHTSA is the one that tracks this these sorts of statistics most closely. And the problem with statistics at this point are that many states, including including California, don't keep statistics of which cars are involved in which accidents. Okay, so there are statistics about how many visually impaired people are hit, how many deaf people are hit, elderly, that sort of thing, but the cars are generally not recorded. There are some states where they do record the cars, but these happen to be states that don't have a lot of hybrid cars, at least as of when this data was collected. Now, we all know that Green California has the most hybrid cars in the country. Unfortunately, we're unable to determine whether these hybrid cars cause a danger, at least in terms of formal statistics, for the reason that they don't actually have records of the type of cars involved with the accidents. What NHTSA does know, though, is something kind of interesting. There have been enough accidents with pets, with hybrid cars, to know that they do cause a danger to pets. There happens to have been a lot of accidents with dogs and cats running in front of hybrid cars, likely because they couldn't hear them. The statistics on human injury, the formal statistics on human injury is still too early. But as I'm sure you're aware, there's been a congressional bill put forward as well as a state bill that you probably know was vetoed by our governor, that was put forward by Alan Lowenthal. Both of these bills proposed to study the question. There's no argument being made that cars should be changed necessarily. The arguments in these bills are to study the questions more than anything else. But as a researcher that studied the problem for a while and as a member of the Society of Automotive Engineers, I can tell you that there actually has been very, very little research on this problem directly. There has been research on auditory approach. There's been research on how blind individuals use car sounds to know when it's safe to cross a street, but there has been very little direct research on whether or not quiet cars pose a problem in those contexts. Now, as I said, let me tell you a little bit about the type of issues with hybrid cars and electric cars, where it poses a problem. As I said, the problem seems to be most serious when the car goes less than 20 miles an hour. So above that, there's enough, again, tire sound, there's enough aerodynamic sound to make them audible. Below this, though, there just isn't enough of those type of sounds. So when cars are going 10, 15, 5 miles an hour, that seems to be the what we call the silent but deadly zone. Now, of course, it's at those speeds that we often interact most with cars, right? When we're trying to get through a parking lot, when we're crossing a street where the cars are slowing down or speeding up, leaving a stop sign, cars are often going lower than 20 miles an hour, so there's a lot of concern. There have been some initial tests conducted on the intensity differences between hybrid and combustion engine cars, and this might not mean a lot to most of you, but this evidence found that for sedan cars, normal like Priuses, hybrid Camrys, when they're going less than 20 miles an hour, when they're in their electric mode, they're about 15 decibels quieter than combustion engine cars going at the same speed. And if you're a fan of decibels, you know that's substantial. The question is, though, this is something we're concerned of in our lab, is it's one thing to test the decibels. It's another thing to see how audible they are based on human perceptual judgment. Sometimes one doesn't necessarily predict the other all that well. I think it, even though the engineering community is very concerned with the decibel levels, I strongly believe and I strongly push and tell the Society of Automotive Engineers that we need to test people as they listen to these cars and make judgments about whether or not it's safe or whether or not they could tell where the car is coming from. Now, here's a little geeky aside I'm going to make. I just want you to know a little bit about the brain, and I'll try to make this as intuitive as possible. The research I did, one of the research programs I've had before I got into the actual practical problem, was on the perception of auditory approach in general. And what you should know, the big story here is about auditory approach, is that the brain seems to be wired to detect approaching sound sources, and that's true of all of us, regardless to the degree at which we're visually impaired. That is true of infants. It's true of monkeys that have been studied. the brain reacts differently to sounds approaching than it does sounds being still or sounds receding. And that, I'll talk about the ramifications of that in just a second, but there's, I think, a general consensus that for all of us, the sound of an approaching object, of an approaching sound source, allows our auditory systems to take on the role of an early warning system. So whether we're visually impaired or not, we use sound to, you know, say, whoa, here comes something. I better stop talking on my cell phone and turn around. You know, it's something that kind of alerts the brain that there's a danger out there that you currently aren't looking at but could pose some serious hazard. So as I said, there's evidence that infants are sensitive to this, rhesus monkeys. Tests of, with human adults, which we've done a lot of in our lab, suggest that whether blind or sighted, people are generally very good at anticipating when a sound will be at their position just by listening to the first portions of the trajectories. There's evidence that the brain in some ways treats auditory approach as it treats visual approach for sighted individuals. The brain doesn't really care. It really just cares about something approaching and posing a danger. By the way, there is evidence that blind individuals are better at these tasks, at making predictions about when a sound source will be at them, but that really doesn't do anybody any good if the sounds are in fact inaudible, which is why I've decided to study this practical issue. Now, the conclusions I think to take from this brain literature are that, first of all, as I said, that it is an issue for everyone, not just the visually impaired. This can, in fact, be one of these situations where the blind community actually takes the lead on a problem that's going to have a happy solution for everybody. And the other thing I wanted to say about this is that the brain, in fact, is hypersensitive to auditory approach, that the brain seems especially tuned to that. Well, there's two ramifications, I think. As I said, we are dependent on approaching sounds, all of us, for that early warning system. And the other thing is that it's probably going to be the case that because we're hypersensitive to approaching sounds, we're not going to need much enhancing sound on quiet cars for us to make them audible. And that's something I'm going to really try to get across here today. And I try to get across whenever I'm discussing this to the popular press, that there's a lot of concern that cars that are too quiet are going to be made louder by adding a backup beep or an alarm or a horn or something really obnoxious. And I can promise you, to the degree that I have influence over this, it's not going to be the case. I think all of us want cars to sound like cars. And there's a number of reasons for this that I'll talk about in a little while. It has more to do with just our familiarity. It has to do with the fact that, serendipitously, car sounds are very good sounds to perceive because of their nature. Okay? All right. So let me talk a little bit about our research. We just really began this less than a year ago, so you're going to see that there's some limitations on how I guess, real world we're going to make this. But I'll tell you what we've done so far. The research questions we decided to ask are quiet cars truly less audible? Are they harder to localize? Are quiet cars harder to hear that so, to the degree that we can't tell where they're coming from? And so is it harder to basically perceive their approach direction? And what we decided to do is make recordings, high-quality recordings of approaching cars, both combustion engine cars and hybrid cars, in a parking lot. We, for you audio geeks out there, we use binaural microphones, which involve putting little microphones in the ears. They produce a very kind of vivid reproduction of all the spatial aspects of the sound. And we recorded cars coming past those microphones, going 5 miles an hour, coming from the left and right, and passing in front of the microphones at about 5 feet. So because of the quality of the recordings, when you listen to these recordings through headphones, you can tell whether the cars are coming from the right or left, as long as the sounds are loud enough. Okay, so we tried to make the recordings as real world as we could. We take the recordings back to the lab, make sure they're clean and edited to the same length so we can do quick measurements on them and all that, and then we play them to subjects who listen to these sounds and are asked to judge whether the sounds are coming from the left or right. Let me tell you a little bit about the cars. In each of these experiments, we compared a combustion engine car with a hybrid car. In this case, it was a Prius. We go below 5 miles an hour because that ensures that the Prius stays in its electric mode. Okay, you might know that if a Prius accelerates, if it goes beyond 20 miles an hour, in many cases it will click into its combustion mode, and we're not concerned with that. Of course, we will be concerned with that when more pure electric cars come out, because they're not going to have that combustion sound, regardless of how fast they're going. So the first experiment, we just tested a 2004 Prius with a 2005 Mustang. Now, we didn't choose a muscle car kind of to make this a particularly striking comparison. It's just that one of my graduate students had a Mustang, as young graduate students often do. We measured the first the decibel difference, and we found that, in fact, there was a 15 decibel difference between these cars as they pass at 5 miles an hour. And basically, we bring our subjects in, have them listen to the sounds, have them press a button as quickly as they can, telling us whether or not they hear the car summing as if they're coming from the left or right. So it's just an experiment where they tell us as soon as they are sure whether they hear the car coming from the left or whether it's coming from the left, right. It's a very simple task to do. And most subjects in these contexts get the answer right consistently. What we're most interested in is how close does the car need to be in order for them to make that determination. Does the Prius need to be closer to the listener for them to tell what direction it's coming from? And in this comparison with the 2005 Mustang, the 2004 Prius, yeah, it did make a difference. The Prius needed to be 40% closer to the listener before they could make that determination. The Mustang could be heard and its direction determined at 5.5 seconds. The Prius could only be determined, its direction could only be determined at 3.3 seconds. But we decided to test more than one Prius, and as I understand it, for those of you that have had experiences with Priuses or Prii or whatever the appropriate plural is, we decided to test a 2006 Prius because there are differences in the different models and the different cars themselves. And we tested the 2006 Prius against a quieter combustion engine car, my own 2004 Honda Accord. And here we found a 13 decibel difference. So the Accord is quieter than the Mustang. It's a professor's car, after all. What we found, again, is the accuracy was high. But this time, the Prius needed to be much closer. And this is a newer model Prius that we all noticed was substantially quieter, and whether that's because it was, you know, it just was better tuned, or something has changed in the Prius since 2004 and 2006, it is substantially quieter. The Accord could be localized. Its direction could be determined when it was 4 seconds away. It's about 29 feet, by the way, when it's going 5 miles an hour. The Prius could not be localized until it was 5 feet away or less than a second away from the listener. Now, that's a real concern, because we believe that it takes certainly more than a second for somebody to get out of the way and know what direction they need to go in. Okay. Our next experiments, we just added background sounds to these stimuli. And I should, mention that where we went to record these sounds was especially quiet. We wanted to get the purest recordings we could. So this was a very, very quiet parking lot away from everything. I mean, you just heard it, the stimuli that I played there. So we thought maybe we should make this a little bit more realistic. Most times when we have to judge the approach of cars, there are background sounds. So we just added some quiet background sound composed of idling cars situated about 10 feet away from the listener. So maybe the sort of thing you'd hear in a parking lot, the sort of thing you'd hear on a street corner. And this makes a huge difference. A little bit of sound in the background makes the approach task much, much harder. Our Mustang now could not be judged until it was about 3.5 seconds away. The 2004 Prius couldn't be judged until it was 1 second away. And this was our 2004. This was the loudest Prius. Moving on to the Accord. Okay, as it turns out, people then started showing accuracy problems. They were less accurate for the Prius with the background sound. They were, in other words, they couldn't tell often whether it was coming from the left or right. And where the Accord could be, its location could be determined about 3 seconds away, still relatively safe. The Prius could not, its location could not be determined until it was about a quarter a second past the listener. If, in fact, you know, this translates to the real-world scenario, someone would be hit before they heard the Prius. Okay. Now, that's, again, with the background sounds we added. It's in the context of an experiment where we're playing sounds over headphones. It is probably true that people are better at making these judgments in the real world because they can turn their heads, they can look at the approaching cars, all that sort of stuff. But still, I think that's very concerning. We have we're going to explore that I think, further. Now, we went to the National Federation of the Blind, and I know there's some diplomacy issues here, but they've been very helpful. I should mention they have partially supported this research. They've partially funded this research. And we decided to test some subjects that were visually impaired. And we basically played the sounds of the Mustang and the 2004 Prius to them. And what we found, I should mention, earlier I stated that blind subjects are generally better at these sorts of judgments than sighted subjects. There's a confounding variable here. Sorry for the geek speak. There's something else we needed to consider. As it turns out, all of the subjects we tested at the convention were substantially older than the subjects we tested at our you know, university, where we test, you know, these 20-year-olds with wonderful hearing. So as it turns out, in this context, our blind subjects did somewhat worse than the sighted subjects. The Mustang couldn't be determined until it was about 4.3 seconds away, the Prius 2.1 seconds away. When it was now adding noise, when we added the noise, the Mustang was determined at 2.4. But again, the Prius, and this is the 2004, the louder Prius, wasn't localized until it was about a quarter of a second past the listener. Okay, so it's clear we need to take into account the hearing of our subjects as well. Okay, and that's going to be a very important consideration. You know, I'm a university researcher, so most of our subjects are, you know, 21-year-olds, and I certainly don't have the hearing of a 21-year-old. I know many of us don't. So this is something that absolutely has to be considered. So based on these experiments, I think we can say with pretty much certainty that a hybrid car, a quiet car at low speeds, is substantially harder to hear and to determine its location than an internal combustion engine car. And we believe that we can say that in some circumstances, hybrids are functionally inaudible, especially with what seems to be the newer hybrids and with just a moderate amount of background sound present. We are now setting up the experiment to conduct with our subjects in the parking lot itself, allowing our subjects then to not listen over headphones, but to listen live so they can turn their head, they can face the car. And we imagine this is going to help a little bit, but we still believe there's going to be a substantial difference between how well they can perform the task with a combustion engine car and a quiet hybrid car. You might know a little bit about the proposed solutions. There have been solutions that the visually impaired have a handheld device that vibrates or something, maybe sends out a beep signal when a hybrid is nearby, which would emit some sort of signal to that device. We have some concerns with that solution in our lab. I think probably the more likely solution, and I'm just saying this from my perspective, I'm not speaking for any of the organizations I'm associated with, but I think probably the better solution from my perspective, because as I argued before, this is an issue for everyone, not just the visually impaired, that a very quiet sound should probably be added when a hybrid car is going less than 20 miles an hour and is in its electric mode. The sound, I want to emphasize, the sound does not need to be loud. It needs to be something like a quiet, maybe a very quiet hum or a combustion engine sound. It doesn't need to be distracting. Distracting would make things only worse. I mean, I think everyone wants the world to be a quieter place. We just want it to be an audible place when it comes to something like a car, right? And I believe that the brain's hypersensitivity to approaching sounds can allow this. I really do. And I've been trying to make this argument to the automotive industry for some time now. I should mention that some third-party solutions have been developed. There's a group in Stanford that has designed a device to be added to cars that emit a very quiet sound, and they came down and we tested, we made some recordings and we'll test the audibility of those, but I think they're going to have some success. I think the take home here is that the current research suggests that there is an issue, there certainly is an issue, and on top of that, the current research suggests that the solution is relatively simple, relatively cheap, and not noisy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Rosenblum. We have a little time for questions, and I'm going to ask the first one. Just a couple comments first, prefatory. We, of course, were the organization that sponsored the Lowenthal bill. We wrote it and sponsored it with the support of the National Federation of the Blind of California, and we almost got it. We got all the way to the governor, so I think we can be very proud of that. And we, of course, our national organization is a co-sponsor of the national bill. And my question to you is, at least from your perspective, given that there may be, and I say may, but that there may be some federally supported research in the next couple of years, things happen slowly back there, but there may, we are sort of, and given that ultimately we all know there needs to be a national uniform standard for this to make it really work for everybody, is the state of the research far enough away that we still need to be trying to advocate for as much research as possible, including, you know, state research, in order to enable a solution to be brought about as soon as possible, in your view? Should we still be pursuing our bill again next year?
I do think more research needs to be done to make a compelling case. And research, a lot of different types of research need to be done. We need to now track the statistics very carefully since, you know, a lot of this is coming in anecdotal information about injuries and near misses and worse when it comes to hybrid cars. But I also believe that, you know, from a scientific perspective, it would be really nice to be able to show that this is an issue in very real-world situations, both for visually impaired and sighted communities. So, yeah, I think that more research needs to be done. I don't believe that the automotive industry is convinced yet. I believe that they, in all fairness, are very sensitive. They're very open to discussing this issue. But, you know, I'm not certain that anything's going to be done until it has to be done.
Okay. Other questions?
I have a question. My name is David Jackson. This is all really exciting stuff, and I'm not an engineer, but I live in San Francisco. There is a lot of obviously there are a lot of streets and a lot of cars, and it's very treacherous for anybody who's blind or low vision. I'm wondering, have you folks thought of piggybacking with APSs? In other words, you've got a device in the car, and say it's a recording. And as you approach an intersection, that the car or the recording turns on to alert people who are going to cross streets. It doesn't matter who they are. And then as it passes away, it turns off. I mean, the solutions that you guys are talking about are really, they're really simple, and you guys are really close. I'm wondering if anybody's thought about that.
So integrating GPS information?
Yeah, that's part of that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I don't know anyone who's worked on that solution. I'm not an engineer either, so I don't know anybody who's worked on that solution particularly, but it would make sense. I think there's just many situations other than the intersection scenario where it's dangerous. I think parking lots are one of the most dangerous places, actually. I suppose that if the GPS information could be transmitted that this is a parking lot or something, that would be useful. But, I think that the noise that needs to be, or the sound that needs to be added to enhance the perceptibility of cars is so slight that it won't be invasive enough to really require the car to know when to turn it on. Just as long as it turns it on when it's in electric mode, I don't think it's something even the driver is going to notice, basically. Yeah.
Hi, David McElroy, UC Riverside alum 1976, and glad to see my old school is doing some really neat research instead of the bugs that we used to have. But my question is, do you find am I
We live in a smallish area, and I noticed a definite, over the last 10 or 15 years, an increasing hostility for pedestrians. Do you notice that in your researches? Is there an increasing hostility toward pedestrians on the part of the drivers?
In general, beyond the issue of Prius drivers, in general. Well, I live in Los Angeles, so of course, yes. I actually, you remind me of an important point. One reason we think that there is a scarcity of statistics on actual injury related to Priuses, partly, as I said, there's just not enough information because people don't keep track of the cars that are involved in accidents. But we also believe that at least the early adopters of Priuses, because of whatever value system or whatever they come from, they tend to be better drivers. And they tend to be a little bit more conscientious, buying a green car, that sort of thing. Well, the truth is now more and more cars are becoming hybrid, and you might know that there's some sports cars coming out that are going to be hybrid. And so that demographic might be shifting. I think things have the potential to get exponentially worse the more the type of driver behind a hybrid wheel increases, or widens. Yeah. So I think part of what's going on is we've been fortunate that a lot of Prius drivers are good drivers, are conscientious drivers. As more types of drivers get behind the wheel, we could be in more trouble.
Okay, Robert Wendt here. I have a question regarding SAE, and is there something that, as an alternative to legislation, going to them and working with them, you said you're a member, are there things we can do to enhance that?
I know on the committee that I'm a member of, there are some representatives of the NFB, and I thought other organizations as well. I'm not sure if there is anybody from your group or an associated group. And they have just been wonderful with the input. It's been I think that along with myself, we've all been pushing for the idea of cars needing to sound like cars, and the sound change being the solution, not some sort of remote control or something like that. So yeah, it's been a really important type of input.
For the record, the American Council of the Blind was involved in this, involved in the quiet car issue for a long time. We here in California actually had a quiet car demonstration way back in 1996.
Wow.
Now, throughout most of that time, we've pretty much found that the industry turned a deaf ear to our concerns. Has that really changed, and what's your take on that?
I don't know a lot about the industry beyond my involvement with the Society of Automotive Engineers. And they are there at every teleconference and, are willing to provide whatever information the committee needs to test the loudness of cars and that sort of thing. I mean, there's no question that they're concerned to the degree that they are involved with this process, whatever and it's going to end up with. So, also, there's as this has been getting more media attention, they've needed to have statements ready, and I think that's kind of facilitated their involvement.
Hello, I'm Samantha Shippey. I'm from San Bernardino chapter. I am a person that was injured very badly for life from a bad car accident. I would like to know if we're piloting the safety of these new hybrids for handicaps, period. I was hit again by a truck in my wheelchair and going across the street by a truck driver that left town and could not even be responsible to pay for my wheelchair. And so the safety for all of us that are handicapped and blind and hearing impaired, should be the main issue that they need to know. We're not safe, even those that aren't handicapped and disabled, with a lot of these drivers.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, as I said, you know, the easiest way for us to conduct our experiments is with our undergraduate psychology students, and they're wonderful for helping us, and they're always engaged in the experiment. It's been nice, we've become very aware of the fact that we need to really examine how many different types of populations are interacting with these cars. I should say that we've noticed some hearing issues with these undergraduates too. I mean, these are the iPod generation. So yes, we're looking at aged populations. We're looking at hearing impaired populations. I think this is it's absolutely critical to test all of this. I mean, because you know, somebody might be able to an undergraduate might be able to get out of the way of a car when it's, say, 5 seconds away, but many of us might not be able to do that. So, yeah, it's we're very concerned with those things.
Okay, last question.
I'm Joni, and I wanted to know, have you ever factored in, for example, the amount of blind people that have already been hit by cars without even the quietness, like just because of background sounds or whatever? And wondering whether or not, what I'm wondering is if this... If you had a number of people that were already hit by cars, if they were, you know, more careful, or if they were more apprehensive in these tests, or...
Oh, that's a very good question. We haven't gotten that far into it. It's something we'd like to do. I mean, there's a few members of the National Federation of the Blind that are keeping track of near misses. There's a website people email to, and it would be interesting to test those folks and to see if there's difference in audibility, or if there's differences in reaction time and that sort of thing with that population. It's a very good question.
Okay, Dr. Rosenblum, we're thrilled to have had you here today.
Thank you.
Great information. We'll certainly remain in close contact with you, and we're going to keep manning the barricades on this issue to make sure something gets done. Thank you very much for all that you've done. Okay. You know, I have a sign in my office that my dad gave me. It says, the more you get to know your fellow lawyer, the more I get to know my fellow lawyers, the more I love my dog. But but there are some good lawyers. We have, Lainey Feingold and Linda Dardarian that come to many of our conventions and do so much for us, of course. And, yes, here for them. And today we have another one here with us who's just an outstanding representative for our community. Paula D. Perlman is the Executive Director of the Disability Rights Legal Center, formerly Western Law Center for Disability Rights, a cross-disability rights organization. Ms. Perlman manages the Cancer Legal Resource Center, Civil Rights Litigation Project, the Community Outreach Program, Education Advocacy Project, Inland Empire Program, Options Counseling and Lawyer Referral Service, and Pro Bono Services at the DRLC. Without going into further information about Ms. Perlman's background because of our limited time, I want to turn it over to her to tell you about a little bit about the Disability Rights Legal Center. Thank you very much.
Paul? Hi, thank you. So lawyers are used to standing up. I'm a litigator by trade. Now he gave me a really short microphone. Good. It's hard for me actually even to talk sitting down. I'm so used to standing up. So thank you for having me. I wanted to thank Mitch Pomeranz for getting me an invitation here. I really appreciate it. And Jeff Tom, who turns out used to work at the Western Law Center, probably on the handicap when you work there, right? So we've been the Western Law Center for the handicap, the Western Law Center for Disability Rights. We have a new name, Disability Rights Legal Center. We have a fabulous website. It's www.disabilityrightslegalcenter.org. And It's pretty accessible. I have some very good consultants who email me and tell me I messed up or I haven't, but everything is accessible. You can either download things in Word, and we had it tested this past summer, every single page with a screen reader, a low-tech one, you know, a low version versus, you know, so if people had older software. So I hope that works. If it doesn't work, please let us know. So we are a cross-disability organization, and we want to change the world. I'm a relatively new executive director. I started in January. I was the director of litigation and a deputy director of advocacy before that, and I want to change the world. I've always wanted to change the world. I sort of have this mantra, we can do better, and I really believe in change. Ooh, it sounds like a political speech. It's not. I've always said this. It's not just for today. I'm not just changing my speech, no. Okay. So I want to eliminate all barriers that prevent people from accessing our society equally. For us, our tagline is protecting the possibilities, but I actually think we want to move in the direction of access equals equality, access in whatever form it takes. And that's what we're looking for, a more just society. So we do this by community outreach and problem solving. We provide trainings. If you, at an organization, I heard the woman from the Inland Empire from San Bernardino, we have an office there. We're happy to come out and provide trainings. We're happy to come out and provide speakers. We want to get the word out about what people's legal rights are so that you can enforce them and advocate for them, and we can work with you to do that. We provide disability awareness trainings. Some of you have participated in our Disability Mentoring Day, which was just last week. Thank you. It was fabulous. We have students who really have never believed that they can get out there and work. And then we take them throughout the city and the county. They actually have, they job shadow people for the day. And they come back and they go, I had no idea that I could work, that there was a place for me in this world. And it's transformational, which is all the work that we do ought to be transformational. We also, and I think we have a new legislative agenda to work with this organization and others through our Respectability Coalition to do some work on this Prius and lack of sound. You know, it's really not good. And I've heard so many beautiful ringtones from cell phones in this room while I've been sitting here. And if we can do that, we can make the Prius have a little more sound to keep people safe. The Respectability Coalition also has its own website, respectability.org, and it's a statewide cross-disability coalition, and we're actually trying to get people to work together. We have found that because we're a cross-disability organization, we work with lots of different people, but many disability groups are like, no, I care about my disability, and that's it. And you know what? As we're aging and as we're changing, you know, one disability morphs into a second disability, you know? My hearing's not as good as it used to be, that kind of thing. So things change, and so we want people to work together collaboratively. The other thing that we do is we're teaching the next generation. We have high school students who volunteer for us. We have college students, law students from all over the country. If you have students who you know who would love to be lawyers, we have accessible software. We have JAWS set up. It talks to us all the time. Because if you turn it off, the computer doesn't. We're in it. What does it say? It scares me. If I'm at, you know, work late at night, and all of a sudden this man's voice comes on, and it's like, oh my God, who is here? And then I realize it's JAWS. JAWS is here. But so we're very good at accommodating students. So if you have people, we love to have volunteers. We absolutely love to have volunteers. And we have, we're also teaching graduate students and undergrads special ed law. So we're changing how school principals and how teachers are approaching disabilities so that they're not making exceptions, but they're providing 504 plans. They're not, we're going to do this, you know, okay, because you asked, we're going to take care of this. No, they're following the law and they're writing these into IEPs. So it's not asking people to do a favor, but it's demanding that people follow the law. And that's what we do. And we do it also through our Cancer Legal Resource Center, which is a national program. It's a telephone assistance line, and we go out and we train people. We get money from the Komen, the Lance Armstrong Foundation, American Cancer Society, and our law students. We could not do this without our law students. We're up to 500 calls a month from people who have legal issues related to cancer across the country. And we give them individualized information for their state. We have a national directory. It's free. And then we have volunteer, we have a professional panel who will talk to anybody who needs to be talked to on the telephone. So it's an amazing, amazing service. And finally, we're doing some legislative advocacy. So I wanted to clear up like what happens on our legal advocacy, and then I want to give you an update about some of the amazing cases. This was the year of cases that really had a huge impact on people who are blind and have vision impairments. So for intake, if you call our office, or we have Ask a Lawyer Day in the community or an independent living center or an agency, we'll talk to you. We'll figure out what you need, what's your legal issue. We'll provide a meaningful referral to you so you're not just, you know, making a million phone calls into the ether. Or we'll provide brief service to you. We'll write a letter on your behalf. We'll make a telephone call for you. Sometimes we're going to open a case for investigation, and then we'll write letters, we'll negotiate, we may file an individual lawsuit, and if we think it's significantly important that has a huge impact on other people, we will file an impact case, a class action lawsuit. And those are my favorite. But I like the other ones too, but those are my favorite because you get a lot of bang for your buck. You know, you really change systems. And sometimes, especially government agencies, they need to be sued so that they can marshal the internal financial resources to do what they're supposed to do. So you have disability ADA coordinators who can't make any headway until there's a lawsuit, and then it's like, of course, I told you so. Now let's take care of it. And so sometimes litigation is a very good funding tool for governments. You know, they get to do what they want to do, but they couldn't because they didn't have the big stick behind them that a lawsuit has. And so some of our cases with that are particular, that relate to people who are blind or have vision impairment, is we've sued a bus company at the airport who would not pick up a blind rider with his guide dog. We've sued... no good reason why. we've sued many, many taxi companies. And we continue to still do those kinds of cases. We have sued tour bus companies that wouldn't let a blind passenger on with his guide dog. One company took a vote to decide if he could come on the bus. And he said, this is America. You can't do that. There's the ADA. This is discrimination. And they just said, no, you can have a separate van all by yourself, but you can't come with us. Yeah. That was a bad one. And then, no. So those are, and in our other transportation cases, we were, and I recognize Taliba in the background, we have a named plaintiff in our Flores litigation against Access Paratransit. And we're still, the monitoring period has ended, but we're still really interesting in how Access is doing. So you can continue to call us with those complaints. How they're not doing. Yes, we understand. We have done service animal cases, again, the tour bus case, and also fast food restaurants that haven't let people in with their guide dog. We had a woman who daughter loved chili fries, and the Wiener Schnitzel in her neighborhood wouldn't let her in. She would have to be served outside. So, yeah, not anymore. Not anymore. So it's good. And then we've also sued places of higher education who have not accommodated students with vision impairments, among other disabilities. So they didn't get a reader, they didn't get books on tape, they didn't get a note taker. And from semester to semester, they would have to start from scratch with their accommodations. And so finally, when it's against Cal State San Bernardino, and they are doing $17 million in renovations, and they immediately put into place new policies and practices for accommodating students with disabilities. And one of our named plaintiffs got her master's degree as soon as the case was implemented, because she got the accommodations that she needed to defend her dissertation. And then we're also really interested in access to healthcare issues. So I wanted to... I have about 10 minutes left. You want me to keep going? 5 minutes? Okay, I'm going to talk fast. So, updates. The currency case against the U.S. Treasury. Have we heard of this case? Right? I know it's your case. I was joking. So, isn't that amazing? What a great case. So, congratulations. We're happy. The Target case, I told Larry Paradis I would mention this. There's nfbtargetlawsuit.com. nfbtargetlawsuit.com. I'm going to also add this link to the Disability Rights Legal Center page so you can get it from our website as well. If you tried to access the Target website from February 7th, 2003, and through the present, you may be entitled to, you file a claim form, you can get up to $7,500, $7,500. $3,500 for two claims, that's the limit. And so I really encourage you to do this. nfbtargetlawsuit.com, but I'll stick it on our website on Monday.
Before you leave that, I will also, there has been some publicity about that on our list, and I will also put out something I just received from Larry the next week or so when I get back and wind down from this a little bit. So, because the data, there's not that much longer to file claims, so we want to get the information out there. So those of you that have tried to use Target.com, get what you deserve.
It's great. It's really good. And what it did also is it changed the accessibility standards for websites. So, yes, it has a very positive effect on Target, and there's some cash value in disability rights. DRA, Disability Rights Advocates, is going to, along with the pro bono law firm, is going to get some really wonderful fees, because you should not be rewarded for your bad behavior. But it changes the landscape of websites. It's amazing. So I'm really very proud to talk about it, even though it wasn't our case. I'm sort of competitive, so I wish it was our case. But okay. There's more. And then there's a case against Social Security Administration for not... Right? Isn't this great?
2 out of 3.
I know. It's American Council of the Blind versus Michael Astrew, who's the commissioner of the Social Security Administration. And just as recently as September 11, 2008, it was certified as a class action. And I met the judge. I'm a lawyer's rep for the Central District, which means I represent lawyers to the judges. I'm like a liaison between lawyers and judges. And the judge on this case is really great, and Judge Alsup, and he just got the Burger King case, another disability case, and he has another case from, he has a bunch of disability cases right now, and he's fabulous. So two more things. I know it's good to have judges, good judges. iPhone is going to be accessible, which is also, you know, a fabulous thing. I think that might be a competitor. It's okay. And then HAVA, I want you to understand you can vote privately, independently, and so vote early, vote often. No, vote early. Okay, but vote early or vote at the polling place. I think we really want to make sure every vote counts this year, and it's the one of the first few national elections, and we have sued the Secretary of State, and there's still some issues there, but there should be one accessible machine in every polling place in every county in the state. And then finally, last but not least, the ADA Amendments Act of 2008, which will become effective January 1st, 2009. This is amazing. This is absolutely amazing. It reverses all these horrible lawsuits. So now you must be considered whether or not you're a qualified person with a disability if in your unmitigated state. And so this changes the Sutton case and the Toyota case. It changes, it really changes the landscape of disability rights nationally. In California, we've always had this, but what is so significant about it is California courts are getting more and more conservative in their interpretation of the disability rights statute. So to have this pushback from Congress that says, no, this is how we need to give the full intent to the ADA, it will have a huge impact on California courts as well. So it's very, very important, and it further defines auxiliary aids and services to include qualified readers, tape text, or other effective methods of making visually delivered materials available to individuals with vision impairments. So it's significant for the blind community. Okay, I did it. It was six, not five.
Okay.
Thank you.
Couple questions. We're running short, but yes, Mitch.
Hi, Mitch.
I'll let you off easy.
Okay.
You know, Paula and I have gotten to be friends, even though I just responded to our city attorney on a demand letter that Shauna Park sent to us. But we're still friends, and what she said about pushing ADA coordinators is absolutely true.
Okay.
But I want to make a pitch as DRLC continues to expand, and the pitch is for two areas that DRLC needs to devote more time to. We're seeing more and more employment discrimination against blind people.
Right.
And I know that you have a lawyer referral service, but I really believe that DRLC needs to do more than just refer blind people to appropriate attorneys.
Okay.
The other area, I received a call the other night from a blind couple, I won't say from where, who have found out that they owe the Social Security Administration well in excess of five figures worth of overpayment.
Oh, no.
Now, ACB, we're beginning to look at training a cadre of our members around the country to fight these kinds of overpayment issues, but we're a ways away from doing that. And if DRLC really wants to assist us, we need attorneys who are knowledgeable about Social Security law and can help defend our members and other blind people against these kinds of totally unrealistic, irrational, shameful claims.
Okay, I hear you. So in response to that, I want to tell you I joined the Southern California Employers Roundtable, CERT, so that I can do a better job at advocating for the rights of people with disabilities. Okay, so, and that's through the Fair Employment and Housing Commission, and so I hear you and I'm taking that on. I'm also training our lawyer referral service attorneys to do a better job. And the overpayment issue, I think, is really, really interesting. And we work very closely with the National Senior Citizen Law Center, who is a class counsel on this case, along with, I believe it's DREDF. And so I will talk to them as well. We've done overpayment cases for deaf people because they didn't have a sign language interpreter. So, and I'm also working with the Legal Aid Associations so that they are more responsive. I asked them to set up a meeting the And we're involved with the Legal Aid Association of California so that legal aid associations will be more responsive to the legal needs of people with disabilities that have these kinds of issues because of their disability, right? Through no fault of their own. You ask for an accommodation, you get a 3-day notice to quit. You get an overpayment, you know. So this is, I hear you.
Okay, we're going to have time for one more question.
This is Abby Vincent, and I live in Culver City, which is part of Los Angeles County. And I have two issues. One is voting in local elections.
One issue, Abby, because we really
okay,
short of time.
Then I won't do voting in local elections. I'll do medical forms. I find that doctors' offices and clinics are becoming very aggressive about telling blind people you have to bring your own person with you if you want someone to read the form.
I want you to call me for that.
Okay.
I want to bring those kinds of cases.
Yeah,
we've done.
Good.
Okay?
Because it really can result in people being denied not only access to the information, but medical treatment itself.
And you're right. And we do a lot of training of employers, and we work with medical providers through our Cancer Legal Resource Center. So I really care about that. Okay?
Great. Thank you very much, Paula. DRLC. DRLC is doing a great job, and we definitely need to take more advantage of the resources they have to offer. Thank you.
Okay. Look us up on the website, and we have a toll-free number, and call me. Thank you.
You want to give
disabilityrightslegalcenter.org. Or you can Google us, Disability Rights or Loyola Law School, and you can find us. Is Google accessible? Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, we are now going to turn...
Oh, okay, the main phone number, can I interrupt, Jeff?
Yes.
213-736-1031. But we have a toll-free statewide number, 866-999-DRLC. 866-999-DRLC. So you can call statewide.
Great.
Okay.
All right. Yes, let's hear it for those guys.
Sorry, thank you.
Okay. Now, we're going to hear from Max Flehinger. He is going to discuss an announcement for the introduction of a new Internet reading service for persons who are blind, visually impaired, or who have other print disabilities. Max is the Executive Director of Audio Internet Reading Services of Los Angeles at www.AIRSLA.org. So, Max?
Yeah, this one's on. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me this afternoon. 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon is a tough time to hold an audience. So I'm going to do my best not only to keep you awake, but to make you glad you stayed this long. When I heard the professor talk about silent cars, it made me realize that about 50 years ago, I owned the safest car in the entire Western world. I owned an old Chevrolet that not only dribbled about a quart of oil every 20 minutes, whether the engine was on or not, but every time I went up one of those San Francisco hills, by the time I got halfway up, they could hear me 3 hills away. I'm here to talk about AIRS LA and information. There is a huge amount of information floating around today, more than ever before in the history of the world. Some good and some not so good. The difficulty for you people is that a lot of it is in written form, and obviously that presents a problem. AIRS LA, a audio internet reading service of Los Angeles, a website for people who are blind or print impaired, was built specifically to get the information that you can't get from other sources through us and through the spoken word rather than from the written word. I know that some of you now are going to cringe and say, oh my God, I need a computer to do this. Well, you don't. Technology is wonderful. There are now internet radios that don't require the use of a computer. So if you're gun-shy with a computer, if you've never had one, have never owned one, don't want to, you can still get internet programming on an internet radio. It's simple. It's like using any other radio, and it works. So there is no reason not to tune in to the world today. You're probably thinking of radio reading services in the way they have been in the past. I'm an experienced radio reading service volunteer. I was director of volunteers for the LA Radio Reading Service for about 8 years. And they do a good job, and Jolie Mason is to be commended for doing a good job. Okay, I can do this in 10 minutes. Unfortunately, most of the old-time and probably still modern radio reading services have two salient disadvantages. They use a FM subcarrier, which means you have to have a special radio, and they have a very poor range. And secondly, you have to listen to the program while it's being broadcast. So if your program that you want comes up at 9 o'clock on Friday morning, and you have a doctor's appointment on Friday morning at 9 o'clock, you can't do it. The Internet overcomes both of these objections, both of these hazards. Number one, the Internet is worldwide. If you want to hear an Internet program like ours, and I'll tell you what they are in just a minute, you can listen to it in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Los Angeles, Tierra del Fuego, or Zanzibar, as long as you have an Internet connection. And as far as timing, we podcast our programs. I don't want to run you over with fancy words, but for those of you who don't know what it is, a podcast is just a recorded program. So if you want to hear our program, well, let me go back. If you wake up at 2:37 in the morning with insomnia because you've had too much coffee with your dinner, or the news of the economic woes of the world are scaring hell out of you, instead of just trying to roll over and force yourself to go back to sleep, get to the Internet and tune in something interesting. Lots of stuff out there. We have programs for ages, all ages. We have programs for kids. We have wonderful kids' stories read by some great readers. We have teenage programs. We have criticism of our teenage program, and that criticism was that it was read by old duffers like me. So we got the message, and we got hold of some very bright high school and college kids who are now reading Teen Vogue, Teen Cosmo, and whatever the other teenage magazines are, and the kids love it. And we also have, obviously, we have programs for adults of all ages. Let me give you, well, first of all, we used to do newspapers. We started off doing newspapers because that was the experience we had. Newspapers, we found, were not only intensive, labor-intensive, but they were unnecessary. You can get newspapers on the telephone, and I think NFB has a newspaper service of some kind, too. So you don't need us for newspapers. But let me tell you some of the programs we do have. We have vision research articles. We go to all of the seminars now. We have all of the local seminars. A weekly program of new tech products, store ads, editorials from the LA Times, the Daily News, Cooking in the Dark. You've got to tune in Cooking in the Dark. The guy is really funny. It takes him a whole hour to get through a recipe, so if you're in a hurry to cook dinner, don't do it. But if you want to be entertained, it is really a clever program. We have Dodger Time, a man who's worked for the Dodgers for 30 years has been doing an LA Dodger program. Oh, God. I put my foot in it every time. We'll call it Angel Time. How's that? We have film reviews. We have a gal who does theater reviews in all the local theaters. Science programs, consumer reports, health programs, political stuff, back and forth, poetry, and a very good interview show with Kristen McDonald, who is one heck of an interviewer. We have magazines, People, Money, Oprah, National Geographic, Popular Science, Sports Illustrated, and the worst title in the world, Real Simple. Isn't that a god-awful title for a magazine? But it's a very popular magazine. Okay, all of these and many more. We have 200-300 hours of programming up right now. There's new programming all the time, so there is really something for everybody on Airs LA. Okay, how much does it cost? People ask that. And obviously the answer is nothing, nada, nix. It doesn't cost anything. It is free to anybody who has a need for this service. And the whole thing is run by volunteers. Everybody who is associated with Airs LA is a volunteer. We have wonderful people on the board who are volunteers. Ken Metz, Dr. Bill Takeshita, Norma Shannon, Jay Allen from Junior Blind, Bernice Kandariat, Roger Peterson, Damian Pickering, and a whole lot of people whose names you might not recognize, but who worked just as hard and who really put everything that they have into making Ayers LA your website. Our goal is to make this your website, that you come to us first for any kind of information. We may then link you to somebody else, but we want to be the entrance to the information age for people who are low vision or blind. Now, I need your help. We can't do this without you. We need to know what kinds of programs you want. We put programs up there that have been requested. We put up some that we think you want. But we need to know what you want. So go to the website. It's AIRSLA.org. You don't even need the www. Just AIRSLA.org. And check it out. See what you like about the program. See what you don't like about the program. Tell us that too. And we will design programs that fit your needs. Because this is your website, and we want to do it for you. Okay, do you have any questions?
Yes, sir.
I got an under the wire, didn't I?
Or one or two questions. I'm going to help you design a Giants sign for all those who immigrated to L.A. from San Francisco.
Oh, my.
How do I get one of them radios, those internet radios? How do you get one of those?
That I will have to find out for you. I'll find, if you let me know who you are, I'll find
my
out for you.
My name is Walt Rames. I just want to know how you get
okay, one. I'll come over and get your address or email address or something.
All right.
We're not handling. We didn't want to get into the radio business.
Well, because I just wonder if they have other receivers, because not everybody has computers.
He can talk to you after the program.
I'll talk to you after.
Okay, that's fine.
And I'll get the information to you.
That's very fine.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Oh, one other thing. If you want to email us, you can email us your ideas for at info@AIRSLA. That's info@AIRSLA.org. Or you can call us at 818-705-6434.
Okay, Penny's back there.
Hey, Max. Long time no see. My question is this. How do you go about selecting your programs? I mean, how do you select your programs? I guess I'm trying to send the question that way.
How do you use as a user? How do you select the programs?
No, say like if somebody wants a certain program, how do you choose how to put the programs on there?
How do you decide what you're going to air?
Oh, how do we decide what we're going to air?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. How do you decide what you're
going to
air?
We talk to our. My microphone's dying, but
oh.
To our board members, we talk to everybody we know, and we put in our own thoughts.
Okay, Roger's last question.
I am the aforementioned Roger Peterson, and Bernice Kandariat is beside me, and we believe we have you for tomorrow morning. Is that correct? Or we have somebody to talk about AIRSLA at 11:30 tomorrow.
Okay, great. Roger, nice to meet you. I'll come over and say hi. Bernice, you too.
Okay.
Roger, our new advisory members.
Well, thank you very much to Max, and thank you to AIRS LA for all that they do. That's great. All right, there it is. We are in adjournment.